This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's our weekly news review, and the Democratic Party in Cincinnati officially selected its 9 city council candidates for endorsement. But there were more than 9 looking for that honor, and some of the ones left out are not happy, and neither are their supporters. So let's talk about what went down at this week's endorsement meeting and what it could all mean for the campaign in the months ahead. We're joined today via Zoom by Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you. We also have with us Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Sherry, thanks for coming back on.
Good to be here.
And if you're listening and you want to weigh in on what's going on with the Cincinnati Democratic Party, its choice of candidates to endorse and its choice of candidates not to endorse, you can join our discussion as well, 513-419-7100, or email talk at wvxu.org. So, Chris, I know that sometimes we in the media business can get caught up in what's happening on social media rather than what's happening out in the real world. So if I were following your tweets as I was this past week from this Democratic Party endorsement meeting, I saw a lot of anger from people who were supportive of candidates who ultimately did not receive an endorsement from the party officially. Is it as big a deal out in the real universe as it appeared to be on the Twitterverse?
That's a great question. The election in November will tell us whether that is the case or not. I'm not completely sure either way. But Michelle Dillingham, to be fair, she is the candidate that one of the two candidates who had sought to get on the ticket that was not recommended by the Democrats endorsement vetting committee. And she did finish 10th in 2017. She was just a little bit over 200 votes away from getting on council. So it's clear that she does have, some public support for her campaign and her candidacy. So we'll see in November.
Sherry, will you explain this process to us? What happened this week?
So we saw a subset of the Democratic Party really bet these candidates. There were, you had to say, I would like the endorsement. You had to answer questions. There was a lot of discussion about who might get the endorsement. 17 people sought it, and they came up with this slate of 9. We kind of heard about this last week. And then there was a full vote that Chris luckily listened in on. And that's where things got a little bit contentious.
Okay. Now, Chris, what is the benefit of being officially endorsed by the party?
The party has made a good run lately of putting out its candidates, its endorsed candidates, and getting voters to vote for them at the polls. And they do that a number of ways through mailers, but they also hand out what's called a slate card at the polling places on election day. And they believe that it will, that slate card has been very effective in recent years, particularly in judicial races, which Democratic voters used to kind of skip. And they have done a good job of getting people to vote all the way down the ballot. And as a result, they kind of have taken control of the courthouse. It's pretty close, but they do have nominal control of it. And so they believe that this will help their candidates for city council in November. And let's go back to 2017. They elected 6 candidates of the 9 were Democrats. That was their best showing since 2011, when they got 7 of the 9 candidates. And there was kind of an extenuating circumstance during that election because of the anti-labor statewide amendment that was on the ballot that voters came out and defeated. And that brought out a very labor-friendly and Democratic-friendly electorate. And they are hopeful this year that they can get a large supermajority of the council members to be Democrats this year. And that's their aim.
So, Sherry, I'm looking at the current makeup of council, and it's different than what it was after the 2017 election. And I think we all know why. We've discussed it many times with the indictment of 3 members, the departure of another member. And so there are Republican faces on the city council currently who were not there 4 years ago. Certainly a couple of Republicans had held those seats, but there are different Republican faces on there now. And there is a certain power that comes with incumbency in election years. So what was the Democratic plan in endorsing only 9 and not hedging their bets and saying, if there's a D next to your name, we're going to work to make sure there's a spot for you on council?
I mean, 9 is, that's the number of seats there are. People who are better at math than I am know, the more you endorse, the more you're diluting your own pool. And you're going to see some Republicans, they're going to have their own endorsed slate. You're going to see probably the people who are on council now, maybe a couple others, with these strong showings because they're on council now. And I'm sure there's going to be a narrative, city halls corrupt, put these people on. And so, and I just feel like they're aware of that, and they're trying to get ahead of that with this nine and being really strong. You know, there was a lot of talk. People were very upset that Chris was able to listen to this and make this process, you know, very public and have this discussion out there, which, you know, as a reporter, I actually really appreciate.
What's the deal with that, Chris? Is this not something that's open?
Well, there's a lot of conjecture and debate about that. I mean, in my view, it should be open. The precinct committee people that make these decisions are elected during a public election that's funded by the public. Typically, a lot of these endorsement meetings are public. The Hamilton County Democratic Central Committee meeting back in 2020 was open when they tossed Jim Neal over the side and endorsed Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey. There were a lot of contentious endorsement battles during that particular meeting, and that was public and open to all of us to see, and we all reported on it. The issue apparently on Tuesday was they were concerned that anybody who was not a Cincinnati precinct executive who was on the call or was on the Zoom meeting might vote, and they don't want to have a skewed vote total. I, of course, assured the party chair, one of the co-chair, that I would not vote because we don't vote as reporters. So that argument did not, you know, get taken up. And so, you know, we try to find another way when people don't want us to hear something that we want to hear. So that's what
happened. So they let you hang out on the Zoom meeting.
They did not let me. I found a way in. And so I'll just leave it at that. I can't say how or you know, how that happened.
I don't mean to giggle. I'm suddenly reminded of that scene from the old TV movie, The Late Shift, that profiled the old David Letterman, Jay Leno battle for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno when he was apparently, and this is true, was hiding in closets, listening to NBC executives, how they were debating to make the decision of who would replace Johnny Carson. And now I'm picturing you doing that.
Something similar happened to that movie, I suppose.
Well, it was fascinating because I followed your tweets throughout the evening. And so ultimately, the Democratic Party here in Cincinnati decided to endorse nine candidates for city council. They are incumbent council members Greg Landsman and Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, former Hamilton County Commissioner Victoria Parks, and new candidates Reggie Harris, Mika Owens, Scotty Johnson, Mark Jeffries, Jeff Kramerding, and Philip O'Neill. Now, Chris, I heard you talk a little bit about Michelle Dillingham, who was snubbed, who had sought the party's nomination, had run before. She's not the only one snubbed. Who else?
Brian Gary. So both Michelle Dillingham and Brian Gary sought to overrule, to get the precinct executives who were voting on this to overrule the nominating committee's recommendations. So what they did was they made motions from the floor to replace some of the other candidates. In Dillingham's case, she wanted to replace Philip O'Neill. And in Gary's case, he wanted to replace Mark Jeffries. And so they made these motions, and the committee, or the Cincinnati Democratic Committee precinct executives, the body, it was more than 100 people, voted on that motion, and they both rejected them. In Michelle's case, it was a lot closer than maybe people would have expected. I think she lost by about 2 votes officially when the total was tallied up. Brian Gary lost by a little bit more. So they had their shot and did not make it.
This is where we're seeing that this 4-year term, of course, we're going back to 2-year terms starting next year. This is where it's like, this has been a long 4 years. Michelle came in 10th, narrowly lost to Jeff Pastor. There was a lot of shenanigans in Jeff Pastor's finances, and I think that's putting it nicely. They've both been vetted by Chris and myself. But Michelle got the endorsement in 2013. She got the endorsement in 2017. She, you know, is an activist with the teachers. You, up until this point, you would say Michelle is what the Democrats were looking for, that she is this Democrat, she's a union supporter, she's always had union support. And just, you know, over the last especially with issue 3, which she supported, and the union leaders, while they said they liked affordable housing, which was issue 3 was going to bring, they did not like issue 3 and how it was going to be brought to the city, and it did ultimately fail. But Michelle supported that. That was a big issue there. And Michelle has come down to City Hall and she has made her voice known over these last 4 years, and not everyone has liked what she had to say. You know, their premise when they were picking these 9 people, and they have said this publicly, it didn't even just really come out in that meeting, is that we want 9 people that can get along together. And Michelle fell short of what their bar was to be getting along with everybody. Like, that was the basic bar they were using. Hopefully we can all get along.
We're talking with Sharon Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Chris Wetterich from the Cincinnati Business Courier. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Go ahead, Chris. My apologies.
Oh, no, you're fine. One thing about the issue 3 and Michelle's support of it, a lot of people kind of attributed her not getting the endorsement to that. I would say that in the you know, more than a year leading up to this process, I have heard from some Democrats that that they were looking to, you know, go in a different direction other than endorsing Michelle. And, you know, she's very outspoken on some issues at City Hall, particularly the tax abatements that are given out to both homeowners who are building new homes and corporations that are developing property. And so she's been very active on that issue, and I suspect that played a role. I would also note that the school board candidates were endorsed, and one of the incumbent school board members, Mike Morosky, was a very, very vocal proponent of issue 3, and he was endorsed. And I don't think issue 3 came up during that discussion. It is a different office, but it kind of shows that issue 3 was not necessarily a disqualifier in terms of these endorsements.
Chris, I think I read in your coverage that there was some back and forth between City Councilman Chris Silbach, an openly gay man, and one of the candidates who was endorsed by the Democratic Committee on issues related to LGBTQ people. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, Philip O'Neill, the person that Michelle sought to replace on the slate, Chris Silbach asked him, basically, are you 100% in favor of LGBTQ rights? And what you know, what O'Neill's response was, I support the gays, absolutely, he said. And that kind of did not go over well.
Because he said the gays?
Correct. The way that he put that did not exactly, you know, go very well for him. I think that may have played a role in kind of the number of votes that Michelle ended up getting when she took the matter to the floor.
I also don't believe that's the end of that comment. I don't think he was expecting to have to defend himself. He said this as an aside, but people are not letting, in the Democratic Party, they're not letting this go. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion behind the scenes to see how he really feels and what he believes. And some, like, I mean, I heard Chris Silbach say, you know, education. And so this is important to the party, and this isn't just going to go by with, oh, that was a comment that was said. I think there's going to be more discussion about that.
Were there any concerns that Philip O'Neill had previously engaged in anti-LGBTQ behavior or supportive of such policies?
Not to my knowledge. And, you know, I'm sure that the vetting and the research will continue.
Just perhaps an eloquent term usually reserved for Sunday bridge games between great aunts, I suppose. And we'll have to see how that plays out. We'll continue to follow. Was there any other Democratic candidate to be endorsed that caused discussion like that? Not necessarily on that particular issue, but in a similar tone?
Not really. I'm not sure if you're referring to something specific.
No, yeah, I'm not at all. I'm genuinely okay. Just curious whether, I mean, did everyone else pretty easily skate by in the endorsement process, or were there some concerns raised about others by committee members?
Not that I remember.
I think a lot of that discussion happened in these, you know, the narrowing of the list, which really was behind the scenes, and how they picked, you know, the 9 kind of to go forward to this meeting that kind of became public and really was the headlines this week. So I think that those discussions happened outside of our view.
Again, we're talking with Sharon Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Chris Wetterich from the Cincinnati Business Courier. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. We'll go to the phones now where we find Lawrence on the line. Hi, Lawrence. What's your question or comment?
Good afternoon. My question is for the journalist. Michelle Dillingham and Abstract Theories are endorsed by Our Revolution Ohio, and there's a charter committee ticket out there as well. How viable do you think the Ohio Revolutionary ticket and the charter ticket is while Democrats and the party are divided? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. We appreciate the call. Lawrence, anybody want to address that? Lawrence is asking about, I guess, the viability of the charter committee now that Democrats appear to be divided in the city, possibly.
Yeah, let's take it one at a time. I think the charter committee is trying to be resurgent. They kind of relaunched themselves earlier this year. They have a fairly potent slate in terms of electability. We have Jim Tarbell and Kevin Flynn on that slate. They have been elected to council each before. They also have endorsed the two of the three Republicans on council, Steve Gooden and Liz Keating. Whether their electability, that kind of all remains to be seen. But Keating is a pretty well-known name in this town. So I think that they do have a chance to get a few seats. They've also endorsed Cam Hardy, who played a major role in the Issue 7 bus and transportation countywide tax. And so he's a kind of a well-known quantity as well politically. So I think that they do have a shot at getting at least a few of these seats. And I think that they're going to be very competitive. Our Revolution, of course, is kind of the left-wing liberal group, and they have made a number of endorsements in recent years. They bring some grassroots activism to the candidates that they endorse, and that could be a factor as well. I would point out, though, that there was a lot of energy behind the pro-Issue 3, the housing amendment, folks, and that ended up being defeated pretty decisively. So there's a flip side to that as well.
Sherry, I'm wondering if there's anything to think about as it relates to the mayor's campaign and the council campaign, because you do have two Democrats running against each other for mayor, Aftab Purval and David Mann. But we saw during the mayoral primary that David Mann was appealing to Republican voters. Is there any expectation that the two guys on top of the ticket in this year's election might impact the council field race?
Well, first, I would like the mayor's race to start. So then we could kind of gauge from that.
What does that mean?
It hasn't been like the most quiet. Like at this point, I do think we really were seeing John Cranley and Yvette Simpson 4 years ago. Really, I mean, when was the Children's Hospital vote, Chris? And we were really seeing like issues in the race, what they want. This has been very quiet. So it's hard to tell that now. But I do think that the voters, Cincinnati is ever more blue. There's a lot of statistics in the Inquirer story about that. It's blue, but there is a real awareness by your everyday person that there is corruption at City Hall. And I don't think they're just going to say, here it's business as usual. So it'll be interesting to see how these other slates play in if they want checks and balances. And historically, they do like checks and balances. We see two Republicans on City Council. They like to have like these different voices.
We'll go back to the phone lines now where we find Charles. Hi, Charles. What's your question or comment?
Well, there's three. One, if one looked at the questionnaire given to the candidates prior to their meetings with the select committee, a good deal of it had a significant portion of it dealt with affordable housing and particularly with three. Two, I would suggest talking to the candidates about the questions that were asked at that particular meeting, and seeing what the variations were and how Issue 3 came up with some of them. And three, in terms of the O'Neills, the O'Neill family, particularly Russo O'Neill, was sort of an icon, which is Philip's father, in this community in terms of civil rights, no matter on what score. And Philip comes out of that tradition. And a good deal of the Democratic Party for a long time really depended on Russo O'Neill's support. So, I mean, one needs to go back to the background of the family. And I think maybe the slight of the comment being misstated probably had much more to do with coming out of a Black Baptist background than anything else.
Charles, I appreciate that background very much. Thank you for alerting us to that. We appreciate you offering it up to us. And we'll also note Philip O'Neill is the youngest of the candidates who was endorsed. He's 33 years old and lives in Avondale. Of course, we'll be talking to all of these candidates as the race moves on. So what happens next as we start to wind down this conversation with you all, Chris and Sherry? Chris, what's next in the city council race? It's a long way to November. It looks like pandemic restrictions are easing, so we might see more traditional campaign opportunities be available this time. They weren't last year, so you'll see some people perhaps at festivals and knocking on doors. Is that where we are? Are we on the ground at this point, Chris?
Absolutely. And I think we'll also be watching to see how much money these folks raise. I know that people kind of don't like the association necessarily, that a large fundraiser automatically ends up on the council, but it is a way to get out your message. And it's a needed thing to have happen. And I do think we'll see more traditional candidate forums than what we saw in the primary election with AFTAB, David Mann, and the other mayoral candidates. I think we'll see in-person stuff, which frankly will be a welcome relief, because we'll be able to see how the public reacts to these folks and what kind of questions they ask them.
And what are you looking for, Sherry?
I want to see how, first of all, it would be nice if everyone would be on the ballot. Now, they don't have to be on the ballot yet, but, you know, and this has been pointed out on social media a lot, these 9 Democrats who are endorsed are on the ballot, but everyone does not have those valid 500 signatures yet. And so we still are at a point where we have a lot of people saying, I'm running for council, but, you know, there's a benchmark now, and we are at that benchmark. Are you actually on the ballot?
And best of all, as journalists, I think we can look forward to pizza in the newsrooms again, right? That's an election day tradition.
I'm eating pizza by myself most of the time because I'm the only one covering politics and government.
We had La Rosa's, but it was like individual servings. We were in the for the primary in the office, and it was La Rosa's individual pizzas.
Well, we should all have a pizza party together soon. It'd be nice to see you all in person. I think we're very close to having y'all back in the studio. Chris Wederick from the Business Courier, Sherry Coolidge from the Inquirer. Always a privilege to have y'all on to share your reporting. Appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
You too.
The mayors of Dayton and Cincinnati are on a collision course in the Democratic primary for governor in next year's election. We'll look at what that might mean. And Cincinnati City Council just its no-knock warrant policy soon, possibly. And the local man leading a black militia to combat police violence. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monk. Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley is in the race for Ohio governor, an election that takes place next year. But so is his friend and ally, Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. We're going to talk about that a little bit now with Inquirer state government reporter Jesse Baumert, who joins us via Zoom. Jesse, welcome back to our program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I note that this week you wrote a story about Nan Whaley criticizing Governor Mike DeWine as too weak on corruption. But before we get into some of the specifics about this budding Democratic primary for governor, let's talk about corruption today, because there was a tweet sent out by Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley that you quote tweeted with some remarks. And I believe the mayor has since deleted his original tweet. Am I right about this?
That appears to be the case.
Okay. What was the context here?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about corruption. The Republicans in the State House, there is a federal investigation where some people have pleaded guilty involving nearly $61 million worth of bribes in order to elect former Speaker Larry Householder, who is a Republican, to pass this $1 billion bailout for 2 nuclear plants in northern Ohio and then defend that against a ballot initiative to block it. And so that's been a focus at the Ohio State House, involving largely Republicans. But as your listeners are well aware, there have been corruption investigations in the cities, in Cincinnati, in Dayton, in Cleveland, in Toledo, and predominantly the defendants in those cases are Democrats. So the tweet was referencing Republican State House corruption, but one of the links that the mayor shared was referencing Cincinnati, and 2 of those defendants out of the 3 were Democrats.
So a bit of what we might call a self-own, perhaps?
Perhaps. Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to criticize corruption at the Ohio State House, but I don't think you can ignore what's happening in your own backyard.
Well, in his own backyard, he is looking outside of City Hall at this point because his term is ending. He's finished as mayor of Cincinnati after this year and is running for governor. So is Nan Whaley. I mean, these are two people who have worked together on many issues. They seemed like political allies. Are you getting any indication of what type of primary we might be in store for?
It could be a fascinating one. Obviously, John Cranley and Nan Whaley have worked together on a lot of things. They formed this Ohio's Mayor's Alliance, which the goal of which was really to get the city's viewpoint into the state house, being able to lobby on issues that are important to mayors, because we had issues with reductions in the local government fund where the cities really weren't taken into consideration. And so this was a bit of a response to that. They've been close friends and supporters and so forth. So it could be a fascinating Democratic primary. It is worth noting that Nan Whaley has officially launched a campaign. She is running, and John Cranley has a campaign committee raising some money, but hasn't officially taken that step.
So Nan Whaley, as you wrote earlier this week, is saying that Governor Mike DeWine is too weak on corruption. Is she talking about the similar cases that we just discussed in the John Cranley tweet? Are these at the municipal level, or are there some state corruption issues that she says the governor's been too weak on?
I think much like Cranley, she's focusing on the state house corruption and the allegations against Householder, who he himself has pleaded not guilty. Also, as part of this investigation, there was a FBI raid of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio leader, Sam Randazzo, who was appointed by Governor Mike DeWine. Randazzo has subsequently resigned his position, and some executives from the Akron-based utility First Energy have resigned in connection to a $4 million payment to Randazzo before he started regulating utilities. So this has a lot of legs and kind of touches a lot of different things. And so Whaley was criticizing Mike DeWine for not coming out strongly enough against Householder, against his own appointee, Randazzo, and various other connections.
So what would Mayor Whaley suggest Governor DeWine do about those cases?
Yeah, I think she would suggest on those cases that he comes out more strongly against the people who are, you know, potentially connected to him, and against Householder, who, while he has lost his seat as the leader of the Ohio House of Representatives, is still a member of the Ohio House of Representatives. There are a couple resolutions, one from Democrats and one from a couple of Republicans, that would remove him and expel him from the Ohio House. But Governor DeWine and a lot of other state house Republican leaders haven't come out forcefully in support of that. And then Nan Whaley also had some proposals, if she were elected governor, that she would institute to address corruption generally.
We're talking with Jesse Baumert, state government reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. Let's talk about dark money. This is a political term that's used for some of those political contributions that I guess come from nonprofits and undisclosed donors. And this is something now relatively universal across many levels of government elections. And we'll probably expect to see some dark money funded campaign opportunities over the course of the next year plus as the governor's race rolls around. What did Nan Whaley have to say about dark money and perhaps some of it being spent on her own behalf in the future?
Yeah, so one of the platforms that she wants to reform is more transparency on the source of that dark money. After the Citizens United case about a decade ago, corporations were able to donate unlimited amounts of money to these nonprofits, usually 501c4 nonprofits, and those groups don't need to disclose their donors. And what happened, for example, in House Bill 6, State House investigation, is those nonprofits start giving to other nonprofits, and it just becomes like the Russian nesting dolls of dark money groups. Very hard to find out where the money originated. And so there's been this push for disclosure and transparency on that money, which in a lot of instances is completely legal to give. But your average person doesn't know what the committee for puppies and rainbows and sunshine actually means, because there's really no information about it. So I asked her, there's going to be money spent in this campaign. How are you going to ensure that there is that disclosure? And Whaley essentially said that, you know, the best they can do is ask groups to disclose it if they're going to support her gubernatorial bid. So we'll see how that plays out.
So Nan Whaley announced her candidacy earlier, and your reporting indicates that she has, quote, vacuumed up endorsements from state House Democrats and unions. What lane does Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley have as he starts to carve out his own opportunities in this budding Democratic primary for governor?
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I think he is trying to run a little bit to the right of Nan Whaley, just my observation so far. He, speaking of tweets, he was saying that Governor Mike DeWine's shutdown was disastrous, which is kind of out of step with what a lot of Democrats would say. They were supportive of the initial shutdowns and subsequent curfews on businesses to slow the spread of COVID-19. A number of Cincinnati area representatives who are Democrats didn't endorse Nan Whaley, and then the two top leaders of the House and the Senate at the State House for the Democrats haven't endorsed yet. So there are endorsements to be had, and perhaps they're waiting out of deference for the whole field being out there to look at.
We're talking with Jesse Baumert, state government reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. The reference you just made to John Cranley calling Governor DeWine's shutdown policy disastrous, in an article you wrote, Cranley sort of blames this for the spike in crime here in the city. How did he connect those?
Well, it's, you know, Twitter. It started with a tweet from the Ohio Republican Party that was slamming John Cranley for the increase in crime in Cincinnati this past year. And there were more homicides, a record number in recent years, as my colleagues have reported. There was also an increase in violent crime. And kind of conversely, there was a reduction in property crime, which might make sense. If everyone's sitting at home, it's harder to steal their stuff. So he was replying to that saying, you know, no, it isn't city policies that are to blame for this rise in violence. It was a kind of a national trend, and Mike DeWine's shutdown didn't help. But John Cranley himself was supportive, at least initially, of the shutdown. He closed City Hall when there was a spike in employees having COVID-19 cases. So I think a number of Democrats kind of pointed that out, saying, you know, is this hypocritical? When I talked to Cranley, he said he was focusing largely on the curfew, which required bars and restaurants to close early. And he was critical of that policy from DeWine, saying that it was forcing people to these after parties that at Airbnbs or at parks, that was leading to kind of unintended consequence of violence in other places.
Meanwhile, Jesse, Governor DeWine is facing criticism, of course, from members of his own party. He was heralded pretty early in the pandemic as a Republican governor who was taking the right steps in combating the coronavirus here in Ohio. What type of challenges is he facing from Republicans at this point in his governorship, particularly as he starts to gear up to run for re-election next year?
Yeah, I think the challenge has been there are a lot of very loud, very vocal voices in this group of Republicans who are extremely frustrated with the restrictions that Governor Mike DeWine put in place, closing businesses, closing the polls, and, you know, having a largely mail-in election. And they would have preferred DeWine to act more like Governor DeSantis or Governor Noem in North Dakota. So the question is, how large is that group of people? Will they feel the same when perhaps we aren't thinking about COVID-19 every waking second? And then if there is this dissension in the Republican Party, which there certainly is a percentage of the party that is not a fan right now, is there another candidate who can come along and really capitalize on that?
That's an interesting perspective you offer there, that, you know, the pandemic is starting to ease here and hopefully will continue to do so. And by the time the Republican primary rolls around next year, then we'd be almost a year removed from many of the strictest measures. So what will people's memories be like about the governor's handling of that? And will those anti-lockdown political candidates be able to take advantage of it the way they would if the election had been this year? Anybody actually running against Governor DeWine on the Republican side right now?
So right now, the only actual candidate is a Canal Winchester farmer named Joe Blystone, who I think everyone would call a long shot. He is really taking like the Trumpia, the most Donald Trump like route to this, and even saying some things like, oh, Donald Trump won Ohio by 15 percentage points when really he won it by 8 percentage points. So, but of the candidates who are likely to get into the race, former U.S. Representative Jim Renacci, who ran unsuccessfully against Sherrod Brown in 2018, is working on an ad. So I got to assume that's coming soon. Another person who has talked about it is Congressman Warren Davidson, and not really sure where his head is at on that option right now.
Well, I'm sure we will have cause to check in with you again before the governor's race next year. We also have to keep an eye on that Senate primary coming up next year as well. Jesse Baumert is a state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Jesse, thank you so much for the time you gave us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our weekly news review now with WVXU reporter Jolene Almendarez, who joins us now via Zoom. Jolene, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael.
So I think a lot of us learned about no-knock warrants for the first time last year after the tragic killing of Breonna Taylor in Louisville at the hands of police there. Her name became synonymous with the racial justice movement that transpired all last summer and still resonates greatly across the country. Before we dive into what Cincinnati is doing, would you mind just telling our listeners how a no-knock warrant is typically defined?
Right. So a no-knock warrant is when police get a warrant signed by a judge that says they can show up to a house, knock the door in, and arrest somebody in there for whatever crime. In Cincinnati, no-knocks from the research we did were primarily used in drug cases. And kind of the argument from that, according to an expert I previously interviewed, is that it preserves evidence. So if you think somebody has drugs or something like that, they can't just flush it down the toilet or something. It lets people collect evidence.
Okay, so the idea that Cincinnati is considering changes to its no-knock warrant policy, this isn't a coincidence, right, after what went down last year 100 miles from here?
Not at all. This was sparked directly from what happened to Breonna Taylor. Although hers was a knock and announce warrant, they're slightly different. It still involves a forced entry into a home, but they do knock and announce themselves first. Of course, whether you hear it, if you're in bed, obviously that's something you may not hear. So Councilmember Chris Seelbach kind of introduced a few suggestions and suggested changes months and months ago based on what happens to Breonna Taylor. Yes.
So has city council voted on this? Do they need to? I understand that there was a memo published by city manager Paula Boggs-Buthing to Mayor John Cranley and members of council. What happens now?
Right. So it's so interesting because this whole thing happened with so little fanfare. I mean, people were talking about Breonna Taylor and no-knock warrants throughout the entire summer, last summer, and for the months following. You know, changes to no-knock warrants have kind of been on the forefront of police reform throughout the whole country. And then this really happened in Cincinnati with very little fanfare. We caught this days after it was published, just a memo from the city manager to everybody saying that the police department will be making changes to its written procedures involving the execution of no knocks and other forced entry kinds of warrants. So what kind of held this whole thing up before was there was this conversation. It's not necessarily that people were really upset at changes to no-knock warrants. It was really because they weren't sure if city council could tell the police what to do. And so there was a lot of back and forth in that. That's what stalled it back probably the end of January, early February this year. And now there was kind of promise at the time that there was going to be conversations with the community, with elected officials, with the police department about what made sense what kind of changes made sense. And this appears to be the result. It was released earlier this week.
We're talking with WVXU reporter Jolene Almendarez. Jolene, walk us through some of the highlights of the requirements that will be added to the police department's written procedures as they relate to no-knock warrants.
Right. So this is the biggest one here, that people don't want no-knock warrants used unless that someone is in serious risk of being harmed. People don't want to see this used in drug raids and things like that. And so that is something that is going to be a change. Police aren't going to be able to do it unless someone is at risk of serious harm. And they also, when applying for the warrant, have to say why nothing else will work, why they immediately have to enter to save somebody from harm. It also, you know, meets a lot of the requirements that were part of what Chris Steelbach introduced and what folks at the Black United Front were supporting previously. And that was, it requires 24 hours of surveillance before you go in. You have to talk about other people who you may run into, children, other people living at a residence. You have to wear a uniform that can be standard or tactical, but you do have to wear a uniform if you are executing a forced entry. You have to make sure your camera is on when you leave your vehicle. And you have to basically ensure that the probable cause you present to the court is up to date. It's recent, and that it makes sense to execute this warrant based on the timeliness of that probable cause. So it's a lot of points that were asked for, looks like people got.
And I note in your reporting that City Manager Muthing says that she extends her thanks to the Cincinnati Police Department, Black United Front, and the Ohio Justice and Policy Center for their engagement and constructive conversations. So it does appear that the police department is on board with these.
Yes. So that was something that was really important. It came up in the past city council meetings where people said, you know, we've left police out of this conversation. We haven't talked to police about whether these things can be implemented in a safe way. And, I followed up every few weeks just saying, you know, any update on no knocks? And I kind of got a lot of silence. I think at some point someone told me, you know, I believe it was someone at the police department told me, you know, we're working on it. We can't talk about it yet. So it does appear like there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of compromise that was made.
Jolene Almendarez is a reporter here at WVXU. You can listen to her reporting on 91.7 FM or find it at WVXU.org. Jolene, thanks for being with us today. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program again.
And we finish our weekly news review now with another one of our WVXU colleagues, reporter and midday host Ann Thompson, who joins us on the phone. Ann, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You profiled a man named Grandmaster Jay. He's a Westchester guy, and he's intent on defending African Americans here in the face of police brutality. Tell us how you got to know him and what we should know about him.
I began seeing him profiled in various national media, and I thought, gosh, I wonder how come nobody here has really interviewed him. And I just got a hold of his people, and he decided that he would be interviewed. I submitted the questions ahead of time, and I thought that he came off very respectful. He was not the egotistical person that one of the national media had portrayed him to be.
So this is someone who clearly says that they're not protesting. They're responding where there's been violence in a different way. Tell us about that.
Right. He's very clear. You know, we're not going to be chanting like some of the other people. We're just going to stay there and make our presence known. And his ultimate message is, if you continue to offend us, we'll be prepared to defend ourselves. You might wonder, well, how did he get into this role? He does have a military background. He did do some rapping at one point. He was angered in 2019 when the KKK showed up in Dayton. He's like, why did they come to Dayton? There were nine of them. And so he showed up with some of the other people there. And he said, up until that point, people probably weren't used to seeing African-Americans dressed in combat-style gear carrying semi-automatic weapons. And then he had a bigger presence when they went to make an appearance after Ahmaud Arbery was killed and also Breonna Taylor.
That's something I was just about to emphasize, was their appearance. This isn't a group holding placards or protest signs. These are guys who are dressed in military-type clothing and body armor, and they're carrying semi-automatic weapons. What did he tell you about that?
Right. Well, he first of all said that this is the largest Black military or militant group in the nation. He said they have chapters in every city and even some nationally. He does wear body armor. And how did he get to this point, you might wonder? Well, he was saying that for some reason, folks thought it was okay to be blatantly racist as if it were the 1950s again. Especially when President Trump was in office, he was saying. And then, quote, at that moment, I thought it was time for us to stand up, stop talking about it, because apparently there was some other program running in America that we didn't get the memo on. And we appear to be the target of an undeclared domestic war against African Americans. He says that they are neither left or right, nor and they're not anti-Semitic. They're not a gun club. They're not a social club, but they are a militia.
And they call themselves the Not F-Word Around Coalition?
That's right. So I didn't talk to him too much about how they named themselves, but that is true, and they do have a website. And he has goals. One of them is just trying to begin some type of self-policing model that can be applied across the nation. Obviously, another goal is defense of the Black community and then the responsible ownership of firearms. He said, yes, you legally can arm yourself. And also he wants to educate and foster unity among themselves. One goal that's a little bit out there is that eventually they want to have their own nation and have a seat at the UN to determine their own fate. When he said this was not necessarily his goal, but the goal of his members. And when he suggested, well, hey, we could move to Wyoming. Land is cheap there. The members apparently were like, no, we're not moving to Wyoming. So I don't know exactly when what the timetable is for that. But yes, some are very anxious to have their own nation.
It's a fascinating profile of Westchester's Grandmaster Jay and his organization, the NFAC, by our very own Ann Thompson. You can read more and listen more on this story at WVXU.org. And we'll let you go. I understand you're going on some sort of cicada hunt for future reporting that our listeners are going to very much want to know about, right?
I am. I had to close my windows because the cicadas are so loud in Anderson where I am now. But I'm actually going with an entomologist to find out where there are cicada-free zones, because I read that cicadas are going to be at their peak next week. And if you're just like so tired of them or you want to go have a picnic, you might want to know where they're not. And I'm going to try to find out where they're not.
I am really looking forward to this report, and I'm going to go visit those places. So happy hunting, Ann Thompson. Thanks for spending some time with us, and have a great weekend.
You too, Mark.
And we have made it to the weekend, y'all. Congratulations. Well done. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. This music was composed by Rob Fetters. Archives of the program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.